Sir, I like it noted I'm the only one here. There's no limit to the damage we can do. So,
huh?
If we get Jelly? Five more here, we have Representative Tui. And with the two of us,
we'll rule the world.
We will undo the world or something. Mike, after the meeting, could I see you for a minute? And we have Representative Brown wearing a new sweater.
No, no, not new. Yeah.
And Representative Hoffman with a sporty tie. Go ahead, if there's any handouts, just put them at each member's desk. And we got Representative Hanley. No. I think it's his. Imagine we have a bill over there in regards to forgiveness of loans or something or other. First bill will be House Bill 331. It's an act relating to claims on permanent fund dividends for defaulted public assistance overpayment, and is sponsored by Representative Tui. And this bill would give the Department of Health and Social Service administrative authority to garnish permanent fund dividends of individuals who have received public assistance overpayment and are delinquent in repaying the debt. And as soon as we get our quorum, we'll start with that. But I have a couple of other announcements I'd also like to make today. We placed a memo on your desk. We have a request to waive House Bill 394. So what I would do then is like to ask the members of the Finance Committee to review House Bill 394. And if they have no objections of it being waived, let me know before session tomorrow.
Did you say the number again, please?
Yes, it's House Bill 394. Mm-hmm. We have a memo on our desk. It's an act relating to limited partnerships and providing for an effective date. It's sponsored by Representative Moses, and it has 2-0 fiscal note. It has had two committee hearings. Labor and Commerce, it was 5 due pass and 2 no recs. And the State Affairs, it was 5 due pass and 1 no rec. So if you review that, and if anyone does not want it waived, we have a schedule for Friday of this week. So the second thing, we have been, again, requested to take part in the Cambridge Energy Research Associates. As you remember, last year we had a contract with them in regards principally to oil pricing. In the contract, the Senate Finance Committee would pay for half, or roughly a little bit under $8,000, and the House portion would be in the same amount of money. So the contract is there. If you would review it, and tomorrow I'll bring it back in before the committee and ask if the committee has any objections. And also on our desk we have placed what would be a House version of Senate Bill 206. And I believe we should have that on our desk. Yes. It's an act relating to real property transfers. This bill would be a companion of the Senate Bill 206. And I'd also like everyone to review it, and if they have no objections, we would introduce it then as a House Finance Committee bill. And maybe we could take a moment right now and get that done. It's a short bill. Does anyone have any objections then to that being introduced as a House Finance Committee bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Pardon? Representative Brown?
Thank you. I don't have any objection to it being introduced. Just reading it through, I do have questions about it, and I'm not sure that I support it, but I don't, you know, just on the basis of just this, I am not sure whether it's a good idea or not. But I don't object to it being introduced so that it can be considered and discussed.
Thank you. Are there any objections? If not, then we will have it introduced as a House Finance Committee bill. And Representative Terrio is here and Representative Martin, so we do have our quorum. And Representative Tui, we hear about House Bill 331.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. This opportunity to speak about House Bill 331 relating to claims on the permanent fund dividends for defaulted public assistance overpayment. This bill will give the Department of Health and Social Services the authority to collect delinquent public assistance overpayments by administrative garnishment of the individual's permanent fund dividend. Currently, there are outstanding delinquent debts in excess of $500,000. Frequently, persons receiving overpayments agree to repay the debt, but despite repeated requests for payment, the debt is ignored. House Bill 331 will enable the Department of Recovery, the Department, to recover overpayments by a less expensive, more expedient administrative procedure. Recovery of debt would be pursued in the same manner that delinquent student loans are pursued. This bill is supported by the Department of Health and Social Services, by the Department of Revenue. There are two positive revenue-generating fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services and a zero fiscal note from the Department of Revenue. I urge your support, and I will be happy to answer any questions. Ms. Jan Hansen from the Division of Public Assistance is here, as well as Tom Williams from the Permanent Fund, the Department of Revenue. They will be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions of Representative Tui? Representative Terrio, then Brown?
Yes, I think you said that the department has over $500,000 dollars in delinquent debt. This sponsor state says $1 million in delinquent debt.
I'm sorry, I can't hear.
Is the state currently owed $500,000 in overpayments, or is it $1 million?
Jan, if you'd like to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jan Hansen, Director of Public Assistance. The amount of debt that we're talking about here refers to closed cases, and there's about, we estimate, $500,000 in debt on closed cases.
Representative Brown?
Thank you. I think my question is partly answered in the department's position paper, but I just wanted to briefly explore why people would get an overpayment. And it's somewhat of concern to me that we're going to go against them or for an agency mistake. I mean, I can see if the person made some representation that was wrong and led to them receiving more than they should have, that being one situation, but I'm a little uncomfortable saying if the state makes an error and then the person spends the money and then we come back after the fact and said, we overpaid you, please, you know, pay it back, that that will create an undue hardship for people who are right on the margin anyway in terms of their finances. So how many of the errors are due to the agency?
Ms. Hanson?
Representative Brown, the number of errors that are here established in the AFDC program of the closed cases, we estimate about 204 that were due to client error and 106 that were as a result of agency error. I have to say also we've had more AFDC cases, but we've only had regulations that allows us to recoup on closed AFDC cases since those regulations went into effect in August of 92. And for the food stamp, I don't have the breakout. There's about 420 that fall into this category of closed cases. If I can respond further as to why we would be recouping when it was an agency error, it's required by federal regulations for both programs that we make a recoupment, even if it was that we attempt to recoup dollars that were paid out, even if it was an agency error.
And can I continue? What's the magnitude of dollars that are typically involved?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, the magnitude on many of these are under $500, particularly for a food stamp case where the error can be something because the person's heating expense was misrepresented or verified in the wrong amount, and it could be something very small. If their earnings, if one paycheck wasn't reported or they had an increase in pay and they didn't report it soon enough so it didn't count for July and we didn't have time to count it until August, they may have had small errors. Particularly in the garnishment here, many of them are small erroneous claims that it's not worth taking through a disqualification because they are so small, nor is it worth going to small claims court. So many of these would be small, and they would only be garnished the PFD up to the amount of the claim.
Okay, Representative Parnell?
Are you done representing the plan?
Oh.
I have a couple more, but go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll
come back to you in a minute.
My question's for Mr. Williams. And
do you see the hierarchy?
Mr. Williams, typically, if a party wants, if I'm a creditor and a debtor owes me money, I go get a writ of garnishment or a writ of execution from the court after coming to a judgment, and then I take that writ of execution to the Permanent Fund Dividend Office and execute on the Permanent Fund Dividend. What this bill does, is, as I understand it, is allows the department to administratively avoid that process, and I understand it's due to lack of cost. I mean, there are no cost justifications. Are there other administrative agencies under current law which can do that?
My name is Tom Williams, Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Mr. Chairman, Representative Parnell. There are the last Commission on Post-Secondary Education under AS 4323-067 has virtually an identical provision. In fact, I would guess that this legislation was modeled after that because it's very, very similar. In addition, child support enforcement serves us with administrative levies to collect, as well as our own division and to collect on taxes and erroneously paid dividends.
If a person knows child support and Alaska student loan, is there a priority ranking set up for it, or is it first come, first serve on the dividend? I mean, how does that work if you've got competing agencies?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parnell, there is a priority listing spelled out in the statute. Currently, child support has priority, and under this legislation, there would be no particular priority given to the collection of this debt, so it would compete with all others on a first received, first in line basis.
One way it almost makes sense too that we've mistakenly or wrongly given out state money, and so we can let a state agency take it back. In a sense, I mean, can you, I'm just trying to, I'm wondering if you can elaborate some on the policy behind allowing an agency to do it administratively rather than getting going through the process of getting a judgment and a writ of execution from the court. Can you elaborate on why that's a good idea?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parnell, I think there has to, the idea is that the state is making a variety of payments and has a series of obligations, and I don't know all the theory behind why general administrative levy power is allowed. It's allowed typically in taxes, but there are typically when you grant an administrative levy authority, there are protections set up in the system so that there is an administrative process. And there is for the student loans, there is for child support. We have one in the dividend program, and I believe this legislation also provides certain administrative steps that you have to go through to avoid a premature or an erroneous taking of someone's dividend.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Representative Hanley, then Martin, then Brown.
I just wanted to clarify one statement. You suggested that after child support, they compete with all the others, and in Section 2, it says that they it may be taken under 43-2305-065B5, which I think it says in the statute is it's the bottom one on the list, and it says that they are prioritizing that order. So I think that actually, number one is child support, two is court-ordered restitution, three is the student loans, and four court-ordered fines, and I think this would compete against all the others in Category 5, which is debt owed to an individual agency of the state. Is that okay?
That is correct.
Okay.
Hey, Representative Martin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of reaching back to another problem. Let me bring this one up first. Is it too late for the department to hold back on to the future the payments to these individuals? They're already out of the system, whether it be for food stamp, whether it be for aid to dependent children.
Ms. Hanson.
Chairman, Representative Martin, yes, you're absolutely correct that these cases are currently closed. If the cases were open, we would do they could either pay back immediately if they had the resources, or we would do a 10% reduction of their benefit. But since these cases are closed, there's nothing to withhold from, and therefore we go through a series of giving them an opportunity to pay, and then if they're in default, to garnish their PFD.
Okay. And next question, Mr. Chairman, with those people here, Mr. Williamson, the specialist. When we're reaching back for overpayment, what about the hold harmless clause? How much money is then owed back to the permanent funds because of overpayments that we've made in the past years that's tied in with receiving additional checks? Each year you send a bill to Mr. Williams, say, please pay this. It's $38 out of everyone's checks because we want to hold these people harmless from receiving their welfare. So it seems to me that the department owes the permanent fund some money.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, if someone was paid a permanent fund dividend hold harmless to which they did not qualify, seems to be the scenario that you're laying out. Mm-hmm. And I would have to check to see whether we have regulations for pursuing recoupment of hold harmless payments that are made. Offhand, I cannot say whether we have regulations that do that or not.
I see that, you know, if you want your money back, then I think the people want their money back, too. I get more griped about it. I'm really worried about Mr. Williams, how much is coming out in 94 on our dividend. It looks like it's ever increasing, $38 last year, and it's going to be 40 or 45 this year. But if we can get reimbursed by those people who have been paid too much in the first place, maybe we ease the pain.
That may be determined by you, Representative Martin, not Mr. Williams, on what will come out this year. Representative Brown?
Thank you.
What is the average time for the Department of Health and Social Services to determine the overpayment, that an overpayment has been made?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, I'm not sure why I understand the question.
How much time, how many months go by between the payment and your discovering that it was improper or there was overpayment made?
Generally, this happens, Mr. Chairman, happens fairly quickly, and there are, we have time limits beyond which we cannot go. Offhand, I don't know, but there is in federal requirement a date to which you have got to make, I believe that you have to make discovery in. But generally, these are not very old, because if they were really something that happened 10 years ago, we would have no occasion to be looking at that case and to discover it.
Well, are any of them like 6 months old or a year old or that amount of lag time?
Yes, some of them could definitely be 6 months to a year old.
Okay, well, the reason I'm raising this is to think about the opportunity for the person to appeal, because it says you will be obligated to send them a notice to advise them that this is happening, and then they have 30 days to appeal. And you're to send it to the address in their dividend, on their dividend application. And there's a lot, I know, because I have a lot of low-income people in my district, there's a huge amount of turnover moving from apartment to apartment. And I'm just concerned about the situation where the person would never know that this was happening, because they wouldn't have a current forwarding address and so forth, and that it would just not get to them. So one question I have for Mr. Williams is, are people required to keep their dividend address current? You know, in other words, once you've gotten a dividend, we're garnishing dividends for which an application has been made, but they haven't really paid yet, right? And so people are obligated to keep a current address on file with you in order to be eligible for a dividend?
Chairman Representative Brown, yes, there is a requirement for applicants to keep a current address on file. Otherwise, we don't know where to send their dividend check. There is that requirement as well, even if you've got direct deposit, because we may need to contact you to determine eligibility. So most people do keep, and we process thousands of address fees every year.
So what if the person hadn't turned it in yet and, you know, was in the process of moving and didn't have a current address, and then they were going to notify you later, and they would lose out there? I mean, it seems like that possibility could happen.
Mr. Chairman, is there not something on the envelope that says do not forward permanent fund dividend check?
No, I don't believe that.
Can anybody, a post office, forward a dividend check?
A dividend check may be forwarded.
Maybe forward. Excuse me. Thank you.
But here we're not talking about garnishing something after the fact. We're talking about garnishing before it's paid, right?
Yeah. I think my question would be is, how long is a person delinquent in their assessment of notice that they owe something back to the department before the department turns it over to the division for garnishment?
Mr. Chairman, to turn it over for garnishment, we have various procedures that we have to go through. We have to notify them through the first, allow them to an opportunity to appeal that the overpayment didn't ever happen, to agree that the overpayment did happen, an opportunity to pay it back all at once, or to pay it back in installments. How long this process takes basically depends on what volume the individual who's handling claims is able to do at any one time. So there is no set time, but each individual is given the opportunity to respond at each of those. And if they choose to have a hearing to contest it, then that case is going to go on longer. If they just reply, and many of often they do, if they reply and say, yes, I made this overpayment and I agree to pay back so much money per month, then when they default on that, we would send a notice saying that we were going to garnish the PFD. But there is no specific time it takes, because many cases are being worked.
Representative Brown, continue.
So how would you make the notification? Would it be by certified mail or regular mail?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure whether it's certified or regular mail that the notification is made.
Would you object to specifying that it would be by certified mail?
I think I would want to look into that. We have found, not in this particular program, that for some others that, and perhaps it is, I don't know. I would want to look into the costs of using certified mail, because we ended up with a very large certified mail bill for some things that we were routinely doing that way. I don't have a particular objection. I haven't looked at the cost of it.
One more, Mr. Chairman. Are there any known, or are you having any overpayments under the Adult Public Assistance Program, and does this bill affect them?
This bill is in terms of collecting, I believe, for the food stamp and the AFDC program, and we currently are not collecting overpayments on the Adult Public Assistance Program.
And this bill does not affect them? Is that right?
To the best of my knowledge, let me... If we established claims on adult public assistance, it could affect them, because the language references claims under public assistance. However, at the current time, we do not establish claims on adult public assistance.
Can I continue? And why is that a policy decision, or why would you do it for one program and not for adult public assistance?
I believe we don't have regulations that allow it, and I would have to check and see what kind of statutory authority, whether it's just regulations or it's also statute.
Okay, that concludes the material.
You may have touched this, and I was reading as you were talking. So as the dispute comes up over whether the person even owes the amount, you give them notice that you may attach the permanent fund to them.
Mr. Chairman, that's
correct. When you actually go to do it, then you have to send them notice again that now you're actually doing it.
Yes,
sir. Representative Martin?
I want to ask Mr. Williams, how much do you think this would be in process cost to your division, sir? We know what IRS is, we know what the post-secondary cost may be, but this being a smaller group, would it be more detailed? And of course, the processing cost goes to everyone's dividend checks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, processing costs will depend on the number of levies that we receive or judgments that we receive. If the number gets to a certain level, then we would probably contact Division of Public Assistance and ask to do a tape match like we do with the IRS, like we do with the post-secondary education. But as long as they're relatively small, we should be able to absorb that in our normal processing of...
But each claim like this is going to cost a couple hours at least, isn't it? To evaluate, to look into, to program?
As a practical matter, what we do is if we have an attachment served on us that meets the legal criteria, we just process that. We we don't do any follow-up work for that. We just match that against the dividend file and record that garnishment on there. And then our dividend issuance program has a system whereby we will automatically take that portion that's been garnished and send it to the garnisher and make the residual payment to the applicant.
Might mention now, Mr. Chairman, the budget for Mr. Williams now is about $4.4 million, and everything we attach to his department, just a little thing to do, just another little thing. People are raising cane now, and it costs too much money to get their checks, but...
Do you represent the material?
Just looking at this one, these are positive fiscal notes, extra money that's generated, no extra cost to the department.
Mr. Chairman, the reason there is, and Ms. Representative, there's no extra cost to Health and Social Services because we currently have a staff person whose function is to collect overpayments.
Do we have further discussion? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? What action does the committee wish in regards to House Bill 331? Okay, Representative Hanley moves with individual recommendations in the accompanied zero fiscal notes. Are there any objections?
No, actually not zeros. They have revenue.
There's some revenue fiscal notes.
Right here.
Well, it can't be, is it?
Moves with no negative fiscal notes. Any objections? Hearing none, then the bill has moved from committee.
Thank you, Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen.
That's what's coming out of your House Bill.
The next bill we have today is sponsor substitute for House Bill 397. An act relating to the powers to levy property taxes in second-class cities and to combining a property tax in an incorporation question. This bill was sponsored by Representative Olberg. As you recall, we had passed this bill from committee, and then the bill was referred back to committee for purposes of an amendment. And here to explain that amendment is...
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dave Kamrath. I'm a legislative aide for Representative Olberg, who is out flying around somewhere today. There was concern at the last meeting with the 3% or 20 mil limit on for second-class cities for the fact that they do not have educational purposes. So we've offered this amendment to you today to make the limit be 2% or equal to 20 mils. And the reason being the fact that second-class cities do not have educational powers.
Okay, any questions on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Chairman McClain.
You have section 2 where you repeal 2945-600 twice that?
That deals with the fact that by referendum we're eliminating the fact that we have to go to the vote of the people to raise the millage rate. And the reason we're doing this is that in first class and home rule cities and boroughs, you don't have to do it in a referendum. The max is 30 mils. So anytime the city or borough wants to raise their limits, it's done by city council or borough assembly. Has this answered your question?
Yes.
Representative McClain? Mm-hmm. Partner McClain,
thank
excuse
you.
Me.
Do you represent the Navarre?
Yeah, I talked to Representative Olberg and told him I thought that this was better than what we passed out before, and that I really didn't have any problem with it. I thought there was another concern, and that is that when, you know, something that you've been working on, here's Mr. Chairman, that is organizing communities around the state into boroughs. If you get to the point where a second class city has raised their taxes up to a certain level under the new authorization, it's going to be a tremendous disincentive to organizing into a borough. That's one concern. The other concern is that while this is better because it still leaves some flexibility in under the cap, the state has a 20 mil cap right now. So this would eliminate all of the potentially eliminate all of the ability for the state up to the 20 mil cap, and it's quadrupling what is now available. And I guess I was wondering, for the cities that were looking at the ability to increase their tax, how many of them would envision even doubling?
Well, Mr. Chairman, through the chairman, representing of our, my visiting with Gary Williams, the city manager of Whittier, who initially we sponsored this legislation for, what their attempt is, of course, to try to have a means to generate revenue. And he does not foresee where they're going to immediately go to 20 mils. The city councils elected by the people, and of course the people communicate with the city council. So to just quadruple your mill rate off the bat is very highly unlikely. But again, you know, one individual can't make a statement for, I think there's 116 second-class cities out there in the state of Alaska today. So, of course, some of those second-class cities currently are in organized rurals, so not all would be addressed.
Representative Navarre?
One other concern, and that is with respect to a number of the second-class cities, particularly in some of the rural areas of the state, a huge portion of the property is probably tax-exempt. So, and I'm not sure, but it may end up having a real impact in some of those communities, because in order to raise any kind of funds, you'd probably have to raise it to a significant level. That's a local decision, I guess, by local councils. I guess we can leave it up to them. I just think that this is something that we're maybe going to have to revisit.
Do you have any other questions?
Yes.
Representative Martin and then Brown.
Just, so number one, what are you calling it? Is there any limit by statute, real property, personal property? Does this mean vehicles, your boats, your planes, land itself, houses? How far does this extend?
I don't understand. How far it?
Well, how far are you in this bill here classifying real property or personal property? In some areas, we have planes are attached, but automobiles aren't.
I believe
vehicles may be, but others aren't.
I believe Representative Martin, and I could be error there, but personal property is up to the local municipality whether they tax it or not. So again, that would be up to the local municipality to make that decision, whatever their regulations are on dealing with those. Some cities,
state with this bill here, we're leaving it up to local government.
It's up to local issue, yes, sir.
Okay. Now, from that point on, are we also allowing the local citizens to have a vote, or does that depend on the charter? Are a number of cities, second class, going to have to change their charter according to if the citizens want to vote on this?
I am not up on that. I could not honestly answer. I could be erred in answering.
In a second-class municipality, it would be the city council or the borough assembly that would set the mill levy.
Right.
And by ordinance, they'd also set under real property, whether it be automobiles, airplanes, or whether there would be any exemptions or not.
With you there. Now, to what degree, since we're going to expand the power of the local government, are the people protected against the government by the rights to say, no, that's too high, that's too low, or we're voting for a cap or whatever?
Well, right now, it's my understanding that second-class cities are limited to, what, 6 mils?
5 mils, sir.
5 mils.
And yes, it's 5 mils, but we're going to open that.
And right? This would increase it to 20 mils.
Yes. So the opposite, then, is the city. We're going to allow them, but I want the citizens back home not to be subject suddenly to a 20 mil. They need to have the option, and is that for them to fight and say, look, we want to change our charter so that we have the rights to say through our local assembly, through our local city officials, we'll allow you up to 6%, 8%. We don't want 20%. Is there a balance in between there?
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
Being from a home rule borough, as a property payer, one of the things that we do is any citizen can appeal it and go before the city council, or you can file a petition. So if you
your
have
property.
Enough, yeah.
But that's still, the city's still allowed to say, we're assessing your property up to 15 mils, 30 mils, because we're saying the value is.
Mm-hmm.
But the city says we want a cap on you. We don't want everything up to 20%. We want everything at maybe 15% or 10%. I don't think this is substantial increase in local government.
I wish I knew, but second-class cities are limited in what they can do without a vote of the people.
I don't know if they are.
I know a second-class borough, in which most of the boroughs in the state of Alaska can only do three things: education, planning and zoning, and taxation.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else, they would need a vote of the people.
Right.
So I would assume...
Percentage of tax, too, because Fairbanks does it, your city does it.
Second-class cities would be planning and zoning and taxation. That would be their powers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, when we were researching this thing a few weeks back, one of the reasons they... CNRA says one of the reasons that the 5 mils or half a percent was put on there was the fact when, back in the early 60s, when the move was to organize, a lot of small village type cities and villages and so on, people didn't want to get taxed. They were concerned about tax limits.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the half a percent was hung on there. Today, I think 25 years later, because I think it happened in 64, so my memory's any good, I guess that's 30 years, excuse me. I think the area's grown, government has grown, and I think the people, one, have the opportunity to, when you propose a budget for the city, you have public meetings. You just don't bang the gavel. I know in Anchorage there's a lot of concern, and I guarantee you in a rural area there's lots of concern percentage-wise. People get involved when you're trying to tax them, and I don't foresee where there's a problem there. By having a vote on all these issues, every year you have a vote, it costs money when you have a referendum vote, and city government's trying
price
to
of democracy.
Stream down.
Yeah, price of democracy. Have it all over the nation.
I know it's a...
Yep.
Everything's cost them democracy.
The people of the municipality would elect their city council members, and I'm sure if the mill levy was too high, they would re-elect it. The concern that I have on this legislation, and I think as Representative Tavar pointed out, that I could see the potential of probably two very wealthy second-class cities being incorporated, and that would be Glen Ellyn and the Copper Center. If they could get 20 mils off the pipeline, mm-hmm. they could become pretty rich. And the state, of course, would be the loser because we get the property tax levy at this time.
Well, to add to that, Mr. Chairman, I served on the city council in Delta Junction in 87, I believe, 88. They had the initiative to organize boroughs, and if I recall, our education district was to be our boundary, and if I remember right, it was approximately $13 million that we would have got off the pipeline, which today is currently going into the budget, and the city gets approximately $100,000 in municipal assistance, and the school gets approximately $6 million, and the rest somebody else is getting. So, you know, sometimes organization doesn't always help. We're helping somebody else by not being organized in my particular district.
If you would North Slope Borough, City of Valdez. Representative Henley?
Yeah, I guess there's three questions on the amendment. One is, are we going to raise it to the mill rate that they can charge? The second one is, are we going to allow them not to have to do it by petition of the people, so that we just vote it? And the last one is this section that we're repealing, section two. So those are the three things in the bill. I want to focus on that last section a little bit. I just looked at it again anytime we're repealing things. And I'm not sure that, I think the assumption is that that is tied in with doing this by referendum, but I don't think that's the case. And I'm not sure you want to repeal that. And what it says is that a petition for a second-class city incorporation may request that a property tax proposal be placed on the same ballot. If you do that, then the petition has to state the proposed tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
The petition may request that incorporation be dependent on the passage of the property tax proposition. If so, the incorporation proposition fails if the property tax fails. This is giving flexibility to areas to say, we don't want to incorporate if the people aren't going to support a tax. Now, I guess you could say because the second class city, the members of it could go ahead and incorporate and just impose the tax, so they wouldn't have to go to the voters to do that. But I don't think this requires that effort. And if somebody wanted to do that to see whether the people were willing to pay a tax to incorporate, I would think this gives people flexibility. It's a may rather than a shall, and I don't know that I don't think it's tied to. I think you could still remove the by referendum in the top paragraph and not repeal this, and it wouldn't affect what you're doing, but it'd still leave more flexibility for the local community. So,
further discussion? Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question, and I don't. Maybe someone on the committee knows. I thought the oil and gas pipeline property tax was a separate body, a separate statute from the regular property tax.
Yeah, the way I understand it is all oil and gas facilities, including the pipeline, is assessed by the state. However, in those organized municipalities, those municipalities may tax up to 20 mils, provided, of course, the tax that they place on the pipeline is the same tax they place, or the same levy they place on all other property within their boundaries.
So this bill then does affect the, as you stated, it's clear that it does allow a second-class city to further eat into state revenue off the pipeline property tax?
I don't know if there are any. I just said that there could be a potential. I think Glen Allen would be a potential, and Copper Center would be a potential.
Would that have to be, I guess, within the boundary of that second-class city?
I think the pipeline runs very close to those areas.
To their area, or they can probably amend their boundary to take it in. Well, that is a big concern, I would think, that we would want to really be very careful about that. I'm wondering whether this fiscal note ought to be revised to make some mention of the potential impact, negative impact on state revenue if we were to pass this. And maybe somebody could tell us what is the dollar amount of the potential impact on state revenue if second-class cities who currently could use this.
It would be hard because, first of all, you'd have to take a hypothetical boundary and determine how much oil and gas properties were within that area, and then how much 20 mils would raise.
Could we at least have some, shouldn't we at least have some note in the fiscal note of the narrative that says, you know, while not possible to precisely say, certainly this possibility exists and that it would potentially directly reduce state revenue?
Chairman McLean?
Yeah, I think Department of Community and Regional Affairs can work around some figures, approximately what would be impacted and what the property rates are, and if they are right near within the pipeline, because they can tax the properties that are on their boundaries, within their boundaries.
The local boundary commission did a study about 2 or 3 years ago, and the study looked at the unorganized areas of Alaska, and they gave recommendations as those areas that they felt should be incorporated into existing municipalities and those areas which they felt should be incorporated into new boroughs. And I know within that study, they looked upon the feasibility of those areas being able to tax themselves sufficiently to meet their obligations to education and planning and zoning and so forth. And that's where I got my comments from when I said in regards to Glen Ellen and Copper Center. At that time, they were proposed to be in one large borough, which would be comparable to the Chugach, I guess, REA school district, and that they would be a very wealthy district if they elected to tax themselves, say, at the rate of 15, 16 mils because of the vast amount of property owned by oil and gas in them that now goes to the state. The only other historical aspect I can give is the city of Valdez has the large terminal of facilities there, so they have a very, very high assessment. But I believe the city of Valdez assessed rate is 7 or 8 mils. I don't think it's too high, because whatever they charge the oil facilities, they have to charge the individual homeowner mm-hmm. at the same rate.
Well, Ms. Kim.
So I can see your point that it has a potential. Right now we have a potential. North Slope or Valdez could raise their mill levy, and that means less dollars would go to the state. I don't know what the North Slope is now.
The millage?
Yeah.
18.37.
Mm. Okay, so they could raise it another 1.7 mils or so.
You got big payers. Mr. Tim?
Yes, Representative Martin?
One of the other thing I see about that, I basically believe in local government, the best type of government and so on, but I also believe in the people having control. And I have two questions, Mr. Chairman. One, and I'm looking at fishing communities right now, we're trying to get more and more on base, on land development going on, because that hopefully will be jobs for those people. And of course, this may have an impact on the fishing industry, which I don't mind, it's up to them to decide. But is it too late, Mr. Chairman, on the amendment that we did the other day in Section 1? I'd like to have that by referendum in there so that the citizens will have a part in the decision. All of our big communities have it, and why not let the little communities have it also? And so I'd like to make a motion that we rescind our action and adopt an amendment number 1 and adjust it by leaving by referendum in there.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Section 2.
If I may, Representative Martin. My understanding of first class and home rule districts, if the city, the borough manage, the borough government or city administration wants to raise their millage rate, their current millage rate is 30 mils. The city government or borough government sets that rate. It does not go to the vote of the people. Through meetings on the budget review with the citizenry, they decide whether they're going to maintain that limit or not. And of course, as we all know, things get controversial, and sometimes they come down, sometimes they hold the line, and that's what we have to assess, that mill limit.
Mr. Turner? I think what we've done in Anchorage, because of people, assemblies and so on, getting out of line, we did finally vote a cap.
That could be.
Sure helped.
That should be.
That was our saving grace. But at least if people found a way to get around it and control local government. And that's what I'm worried about here. We learned from experience, Anchorage or Fairbanks, whatever, even little Wasilla now, are taxing themselves because they want local police protection. And they said, how much? In my little community of East Anchorage, the people want more police protection, so they voted by referendum on their own little section, the poorest section in the city, to have 4 more police, and we're willing to tax ourselves to that point. And yeah, that's what I'm going to see, the people of these cities. And I just feel more safer for the sake of the people. It's not that they don't trust local government, but we know through the experience of democracy, the best control of government is the people, and that is through referendum, not throwing someone out of office. Maybe too late then.
OK, Okay, Representative Martin, I heard you make a motion, but I haven't been able to identify it in the bill yet. Could you?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Mr. Chairman, for clarification, Representative Martin, are you trying to delete section 2 or section 1?
No. Well, Mr. Chairman, we are back. I thought we voted this in.
There's a section where your concern could be addressed by keeping it there without repealing it. Section 2 repeals it. And that's your concern that's expressed.
Repeals 600.
I think what
it repeals
Representative 600. Martin is trying to say that if a second-class city wants to levy a property tax,
mm-hmm.
under present statutes, they would have to be voted upon by the people. By taking out the word referendum, it would have to be adopted by ordinance of the city council.
Right.
And he's opposed to the city council being able to do it. He says that we should have left in referendum.
By referendum. That's my point.
And my point was, did you formally make that as an amendment or not?
Well, sir, I will make it an amendment now.
Mr. Chairman, amendment to the amendment.
We have amendment to the amendment. For us.
Well, the problem I'm having systematically here is we don't have this amendment before us yet.
Well, I thought we did. Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll move the amendment become before the committee. Is this amendment number 1 now?
Yes, we would identify this as amendment number 1, Carol. Number 1. Okay. We have a motion that we adopt amendment number 1. No discussion on the amendment. Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, on amendment number 1, I'd like to ask that we put back in by referendum. And so that'd be amendment 2, amendment number 1.
Okay, so it'd read a second class city may, by referendum, levy property taxes as provided for first class cities.
On behalf of Mr. Representative Oldberg, I'll object.
Thank you. Where did your people find out?
Further discussion on the amendment.
I just wanted to comment on Representative Martin's, I assume, statement a moment ago. I assume you were referring to the police service area vote that Tom Fink vetoed. There hasn't been a vote. Mr. Fink vetoed that, and the people of that area are not going to get to vote on whether they would have additional police service.
At least they had the right. They made the first move. He vetoed it, and that was bomb.
We were trying to establish that right, but it has not been established.
Through city council, we did it, our local council.
Okay, Representative Parnell and Hoffman.
Since a number of us here are not from second-class cities, and the current statute provides that it has to be by referendum, mm-hmm. I wonder if any of our friends who have second-class cities would care to comment on how it's worked so far.
Taking powers away from them.
The only second-class city that I can think of that's near my district now would be the city of Wasilla. The city of Wasilla has recently enacted the sales tax by referendum. It took them years to do it. Now that they have done it, they seem pretty satisfied. I think it raised over twice the amount of money that they estimated that it would. So we find that Wasilla is unlike some other second-class cities. It does have a good source of steady revenues now that they can count on to provide services for themselves that formerly had to be provided to them by the state.
Mr. Chairman, another just a point of inquiry. Do second-class cities typically not have a prohibition against dedication of funds? In other words, the city of Wasilla dedicated that to police protection, is that right?
Yeah, the people had to vote that in as a power. Mm-hmm. Representative Hoffman and Grusendorf?
Well, I do have second-class cities, and the major problem, I believe, is that they do not even consider
imposing a property tax because of the amount of paperwork it would take in order to collect a half a percent. So there has never been consideration of even imposing the property tax. And I guess I would say that I would oppose the amendment. You know, I think that the elected officials have the responsibility of putting the budget together. They do have access to public hearings. People will come and testify, and I think that if the citizens are concerned about many of the issues that Representative Martin have, they could also consider a cap. But I think that if it's good for the first class cities to allow the councils to determine what tax rate should be set, then I would support giving that flexibility to the second class cities as well.
Representative Gusner?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're talking here about an amendment, not referring to his amendment here, but the amendment in its entirety.
Amendment to the amendment.
That gives upwards to a maximum or a ceiling by the state to local governments. The local governments, in turn, have what they call a charter, and that charter further restricts them and how they're going to do it. I think in the city and borough of Sitka, for example, if we have 6 mills and they want to increase it to 8 mills, that's acceptable. But if they want to go over, if it's 6 mills, they want to go, let's say, to 9 or 10, then they have to go to the voting public. So I think what Representative Martin is referring to is something that usually is handled by a charter amendment on how they'd handle it. All we're doing here at the state level is simply saying this is the maximum that you as a local entity, a political subdivision of the state, can assess. And of course, you're a former mayor too, and you know how you play that game. The millage rate can stay the same, you just increase your assessment evaluation.
Oh, we never did that.
And you could do that. But I would have to be against Representative Martin's proposal, and the amendment, even without his amendment, I think would be good for municipalities.
Representative Hammy, then Martin.
I was just going to say, I know that the charters, though, in most of these second-class cities were probably established under the current rules, which is you got to go to referendum if you want to increase our taxes.
Exactly.
For any amount. So we're taking two steps here. I mean, number one, we're allowing them to tax more, and then we're changing. We're giving the ability to the city council. Now, I think if people knew going in where they're going to incorporate into a second-class city that it was going to be up to the city assembly to do it, they may, within their charter, put in some things. So now we're kind of going to go back, and it happened in Anchorage afterwards where they did a petition drive and decided that they were going to limit the ability of the local officials. But this takes two steps at once, mm-hmm. which were not in effect when the charter charters were adopted. So one of the assumptions of the charters of second class cities is no longer there. So I think it's a pretty it's a step. I mean, it's clear what it does. It's a big challenge.
So should we do it by statute? Then?
Should we do which way?
Tell them that they have to have a referendum.
It says right now. I mean, that's the way they organized when they first organized. That's what the statute is now, that they do have to do it by referendum. And that's what I'm saying. When they organized originally, they knew in their charter that they didn't have to put in a section saying we're going to do it by referendum if that's what the people wanted, because they could. It was already limited by statute. So I would probably support the amendment.
Representative Martin?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's exactly what the heart of it is, that Representative Gusendorf is bringing up, and Representative Hanley, that, as I brought up earlier, is it stated in the charters of the local government that the people have this freedom, then great, you know, the charter is the acting contract of the people with the citizens, or with the local government. But now, are we superseding by this here, by repealing the referendum aspect of it, And if they don't have that protection in the charter, then they'll just supersede. And they don't have the local powers they thought they might have over their own government. To me, it's a very fundamental thing, that, you know, to what degree you're going to allow your government to act you. And if the state government don't allow you to have powers on a local level.
Mr. Chairman, clarification for myself. Representative Hanley, on this amendment, you were concerned about Section 2, were you not, at one time? Earlier in our discussion?
Yeah.
The repealer?
That's repeal.
Yeah, yeah, and I agreed with you on that, that, you know, they may. On that part.
My comments were to Representative Martins, though.
Right, I know.
Okay, Chairman McLean?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have two concerns. One is the repealer for Section 2, but I don't support the amendment to the amendment that Representative Martin made, because one of the things that we need to look at is that we have to give the local governments enough tools so that they can provide revenues for the services that they provide locally. And second-class cities, they have to take care of municipal property, they have to take care of garbage and solid waste, that's optional, public utilities. So there's a lot of things that they have to take care of, and so we should be providing them the tools when we can't even provide them on the state level. Revenue sharing, municipal assistance, we can't even do it.
The Representative Hanley is absolutely correct when he says that this does two things. Number one, it goes from calling for a referendum to allowing the city council to levy the tax, and then it increases the amount from 5 mils to 20 mils, which they may do. Representative Hoffman.
Mr. Jew, members in the first class cities, to be kind to your second class cousins and oppose the amendment.
Mm-hmm. No, Mr. Chairman.
The only question that I'm having is, I guess I was wish I knew Title 29 a little bit better as it refers to second class cities, because no, a second-class borough, one of their three powers that they automatically assume when they organize is the power to tax. And I would assume that one of the powers that a second-class city has is the power to tax. And right now the referendum determines what type of tax they should assess, not how much that tax should be. See down here, it says first and second class city powers for municipalities not in a borough. Property, second class, that's a mandatory power that they exercise. Mm-hmm. All the rest are optional. And right now it says property tax limit is 5 mils. Mm-hmm. For first class cities, this is 30 mils. And what's being proposed here is then 20 mils. And it does have a limit on sales tax of 6% is the maximum that a second-class city could assess.
Mr. Chairman, I may remind some of us, one difference between second-class and first-class cities is the population. A second-class city has to have a population of 25 people. A first-class city has to have a population of 400 people. So there are second-class cities, I'm sure, out there that would like to assume the powers of first-class city and some of the other assets, if I may, of first-class cities, but they can't because of the population purpose, one being the 30 mils. If they could, then they wouldn't, like the city of Whittier that we initially introduced this legislation for, their population, if my memory's any good, is around 270 people. so they cannot qualify as a first-class city. And as my memory's any good, their current 5 mil rate is bringing in approximately $42,000 out of $1 million budget that they're operating on.
Can you rep them to Martin?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, just to call the question, one last statement on it. The major reason I'm offering the main amendment is my concern about the referendum. If the referendum part failed, I'm going to remove my bringing forward the amendment number one. So in the amendment to the amendment, are we taking away the basic local powers that the city now have? Citizens of second-class areas now have this referendum power. That's the most important thing I see in this. Not the power of going from 1.5% to 2%. That's minor compared to taking the powers away from the people.
Oh, okay. I've already changed my mind three times on this issue.
So,
you're losing again.
Again.
But, you know, we are not a direct democracy. A direct democracy is only possible on a very small local level where all the people get together and make the laws. Mm-hmm. We're an indirect democracy where the people elect representatives. And I guess what our question is, that do we draw that distinction at 25 people or at 400 people or somewhere in between? Chairman McLean.
You know, one of the other questions that I have or concerns is on education. Most of the second-class cities are primarily REAAs. And when we were looking at the figures of their dollars that were coming in, one that was really outstanding was the Copper River School District had a lot of money, but we couldn't tap into it because it was by REAA. There's that other area that I'm kind of thinking need to look at.
Any further discussion on the motion to amend? Are there objections to the motion to amend?
Objection.
Any objections to the clerk call the roll?
Is it the amendment to the amendment?
The amendment to the amendment.
Okay.
This is the referendum section. This. Put it back in.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Grusendorf?
No.
Representative Hanley?
Yes.
Representative Hoffman?
No.
Representative Martin?
Yes.
Representative Navarre?
No.
Representative Parnell?
Yes.
Representative Terriel?
Yes.
Representative Brown?
No.
Representative McLean?
No.
Representative Larson?
No.
4-7.
I'm sorry?
4-7.
Okay, please note that the motion to amend the amendment has failed. I'll recognize Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to remove my motion to bring forth the amendment number one. Put it back in the office.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hoffman.
I'll move amendment number one on behalf of.
Okay, are there any objections to Representative Martin removing his motion to adopt amendment number one? Hearing none, then, Representative Martin, your motion then has passed. And now, Representative Hoffman has moved that we adopt amendment number one. Are there discussions on amendment number one? Chairman McLean.
Yes, I still have a concern that if there's going to be an incorporation of a second-class city, that they should continue to have a petition that's going to be signed at the same time as the property tax proposal is placed on the same ballot, if there's going to be an incorporation. So, Section 2 of the amendment, I don't know if I'll make a...
600.
I would like to make a motion to delete Section 2.
Here we have a motion to delete Section 2. Discussion on Section 2. Representative Parnell.
I'm not trying to understand why it's been repealed in the first place. Maybe we could have that addressed again.
Dave, could you help us out on...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I asked Tam Cook about this, and she said it was repetitious, and that's why we were appealing it. I'm sorry, but I'm not of a great legal mind, as you can well witness here today, so I take her for her word, and that's why I went with, along with what she suggested. Originally, what I had sent down to her was the top portion, and originally, I'll be honest with you, I was going to put it somewhere else in the sponsor substitute, and she suggested doing away with sections 1 through 4 of the original sponsor substitute.
Okay, we have a person who'd like to testify on this. Dave, if you could excuse me a second. Yes. Crystal. AML.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just got this amendment now, but I'm sitting here trying to analyze this issue of whether that repealer is needed. It seems to me that if you pass in when it was required by referendum, then you would pass that as part of your incorporation, and it would be equivalent to that. It's my reading of this, and I would want to check with Tam. I mean, I'm not an attorney either, but I would say that if you pass in your incorporation vote, also establish a mill rate, then that does control it from then on, and then the ability, the flexibility which the second-class cities were asking for in terms of being able to adjust to their changing circumstances then would be precluded. So that would be my understanding of why it would have been recommended tying those two votes together be taken out. That you may want to leave it that way, but that's the way I would understand it, that it would in fact therefore preclude any future adjustment to that, serve as a cap.
Further discussion then on the motion to delete section 2 of the proposed amendment.
Mr. Chairman, for further clarification, this would be a petition for second-class city incorporation, and the ballot would be on the property tax proposal be placed on the same ballot. If they're going to be a new incorporation of a second-class city, then that question should be asked by them when they're going to go and incorporate as a second-class city. It wouldn't affect the ones that are already incorporated. No. It would be the new ones that would be incorporated as second-class cities. I think that it would be fair, myself, for voters, if they're going to become a second-class city, that they do have that question on whether they want to levy taxes, proposed taxes.
You're taking it.
That's the way I would take this would be that this would kind of make it mandatory that you said if you want a property tax, the property tax will be. And I guess if I was to speak in opposition to this motion, it would be in relation to the vote that I just cast in the referendum, that once you create a type of tax, then it's the obligation of the governmental body, whether it be a city council or a borough assembly, to determine what the mill levy should be. Now, if the people wish by ordinance to place a cap on what that is, then they can do that by ordinance. I don't think it should be at the time of incorporation.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Martin?
I think I'm in line with your thinking. It seemed like that those people who thought they had the power of referendum in the time of incorporation, that's tough. We've done taken that away from you. But for those who are going to newly incorporate, we'll let you have the power. You know, you've already, people incorporated with a certain assumption that they had basic rights, and now we're taking it away. How do they go about dissolving themselves and say, well, we want to dissolve our charter, we want to dissolve everything, and then start new under the new powers you want to give us?
You know what I would like to do on this bill? Let me just throw it off. This bill is something that greatly affects many communities around the state of Alaska, both present ones and future ones. I would like to see the Municipal League, address three concerns that I have. One is in regards to repealing the referendum, which we have done by a vote here, on whether that is a good or a bad idea. Second, like as Chairman McLean pointed out, at the time when a city votes for incorporation, should it be at that time in which they vote for what type of tax and what the tax levy would be? Or what would the Municipal League's recommendation be in relation to restrictions at the time of incorporation? And we'll give you a lot of time to think on that. If you could let us know, I'd like to reschedule this bill on Friday.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw my amendment until Friday.
Okay. And Representative Brown?
And Mr. Chairman, I guess while we're looking into things, I would appreciate more information about the magnitude of dollars to the state that might be affected by this. And I guess the question I've been wondering is whether if you went to 1% and a 10 mil cap, does that make sense in the scheme of how we're trying to encourage people to take responsibility at the local level, and not being all that familiar with Title 29 and how you have these staggered powers? Is it correct that to go all the way to 2% would put second-class cities at the same level as all other local governments in their ability to have a property tax? And is there some benefit in remaining, keeping some incentive in the law that would encourage people to go ahead and become an organized borough? And should we consider, instead of a 2%, a 1%, which would give them the ability to double the present rate, but would still both minimize the effects on the state's revenue base and also keep that differentiation based on what powers people are actually receiving?
See, on the question you're talking about now, Representative Brown, is really a big policy question back at the time when the pipeline was being conceived. In many states where you have such an asset, say, of such magnitude, that asset belongs to the state and local governments are not allowed to tax into it at all. Other states allow local governments to use that as an asset and levy a mill rate against it up to a certain amount. And that was the policy decision that was made back in the late 70s. To allow local government to assess a levy up to and including the 20 mils. Now, no borough has ever gone to 20 mils, or no city, but the potential of it is there, or the potential of a new city being incorporated along the pipeline is there. So I do share your concern that it could be a loss of local revenues to the state of Alaska. To what extent, I don't know. I know that when we looked at the incorporation of the Chugiak REA district, where Mat-Su had about 300,000 per student, that district would have something like 6 million per student in value, which gave it a tremendous potential there. But yet they were independent Alaskans and they didn't like any taxes and therefore they never voted to incorporate. So maybe we should have someone from Revenue here on Friday to speak on that too.
And also from DCRA to answer questions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I don't mean to put this bill off at all. I think there are some major policy questions there that I'd like to hear some more from AML because it does affect all those communities.
Mr. Chairman, more on the procedure here. I am concerned about the major policy calls we're making. And when I signed the last committee recommendation sheet. I signed it amend, as did, I believe, Representative Navarre. I did that because of the concerns expressed last time regarding the education abilities of a first-class city. And so in essence, when Representative Olberg contacted me, I thought we were going to be dealing specifically and solely with that issue in this amendment. If we did indeed come back for the purposes of any amendments and more testimony, then I think it is appropriate to open it up on that referendum issue and get more input on that, because that is a significant policy call. But I just wanted to put that on the record, that I thought we'd come back for a specific amendment, and it's been broadened much beyond that.
As Representative Grusendorf and I can remember, that was one of the incentives of a home rule, our first-class city, because second-class had to depend on a referendum in order to really institute any taxes. So I share Representative Martin's concern there, even though I voted against it. It wasn't a strong vote.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask the committee approval that the recommendation sheet that we all signed be withdrawn until after this is settled? I think I've prematurely signed that sheet.
Ms. Collins?
Yeah, bring up a new one.
Since the bill was re-referred back to the committee and your action is new action, there would be a new committee report.
Okay, I want to double check on that.
And if you would express our concerns to Representative Olberg, principally in regards to taking off the word referendum.
Mm-hmm.
And
taking on
the and the other two concerns that you heard expressed, potential loss of revenue to the state and to the magnitude thereof the 20 mils. Okay, tomorrow, once again, I ask you, and I had that right before here. We have been requested to waive House Bill 394. That's unlimited partnerships. So I ask anyone to review that bill, and if they have any objections, to let me know before session tomorrow. As if I don't hear from anyone, I will move then that we waive that bill.